Hello and welcome to Speaking From Water, episode 49. I'm here with legendary runner Tom Clifford. Tom has been a staple of this community for 20 years, and I've had the honor to know him for that long. We started our relationship on I guess it was triathlons, and I said, who is this guy and where did he come from? And over the next 20 years,
kind of a weirdo guy, right? And we're not by the water.
Yeah, we're not by the water at this moment. And for those listening, you can see we're on the UNCW track. We just met at the beach, but the wind is bumping out of the north, and it was just not going to be conducive to the podcast. But we're going to start walking, and we're going to start talking, and let's see how far we go, and let's begin the conversation.
Can we run?
I'm in flip-flops, so? I think a level 2 pace might be good for me. But but Tom, I know Tom could run and talk well at the same time. Yep. I think I could probably pull it off.
Nah, we're good. You're okay. In flip-flops.
Here, hold these while I start my my watch, if you would, the little gimbal system.
All right.
And Tom, thank you for joining us. It is
glad to be here.
Honor to have you. And
there's no better conversation I could have without it being Sean Rutke. Like that is, I know it's going to be a good conversation if it's with Sean.
Well, again, we go way back, and I just want to dive home how I heard about you initially. So it was 2000 and it had to be 2005 maybe. And I was running in a 10K down at the Battleship.
Yep.
Maybe it was a half marathon.
Half marathon.
Half marathon. Yeah. And this is at the height of my I'd say triathlon aspirations running, and at the end I got this little slip for a coach, and I was like, who is this coach guy? And it was
my first flyer I put in a race.
Really?
Very first flyer. I spent like my life savings.
So that was the initial seed of it. Okay.
Yeah,
so
I was like, I couldn't believe how much flyers cost. I'm sure now, 17 years later, they're double in price.
Yeah.
But like just getting 500 flyers and put them in the race packet, it was like, I have to put this much money into my business initially. I mean, it wasn't even that much, but like at the time, you know, I was 23 years old. So, you know, it was one of those things where I'm going to put the flyer in and hope that I place in the top three.
So you're still a high runner at that point. Your running is
kind of, when I moved here, I had stopped for a year. Like, I graduated college, I was burned out. A lot of people who run in college, you know, it's 5 years of grinding, you know, you redshirt a year and you're kind of burned out. You're like, okay, I got to get my life together kind of thing, you know? And so I was burned out, and then I was like, okay, I'm starting to get the bug again after like a year off. So that was that age, you know, and it happened to correlate. We're like, okay, I'm gonna start a business out of this. Had no idea I was gonna do it. And I think part of that should be that you gotta live what you do, right? And I did, I believed in that. It's just, there was a new meaning behind it. So whenever there's a new meaning behind what you do, a purpose, and you wanna set an example for youth and adults, you know, you gotta do it yourself.
And did you call it Without Limits initially? Was that the...
No, it was called, I was trying to think of a name, and I wanted to call it High Voltage Running after the AC/DC
I like
song,
that.
High Voltage.
That is sick.
But then that got turned down by the four or five people that were already training with me.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what movie did I watch, you know, before almost every race? And it was the Prefontaine movie Without Limits.
Dude.
You know, so then, you know, down the line, we ended up trademarking that for coaching and events, and here we are.
So how did the Flyers do? Was
great.
It?
I got tons of calls.
Huge.
Won the race.
You won the race.
I still have a, myself in a t-shirt, and on the back it says, stop talking about your goals and start training for them. And it had a picture of like a runner, terrible art, clip art picture.
Dude, I remember it well.
And my phone number. And I still have the shirt.
Oh, that's
good
epic
stuff.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. You're from Michigan.
Yep.
What started your athletic journey? Who inspired you? How old were you?
Yep. I was in eighth grade, and my sister was a runner. My sister and brother were both runners in high school, and they would go do what was called speed workouts. You know, my dad said, if you go run a mile and a half three times a week, I'll buy you a pair of running shoes. you know, because I wanted a new pair of running shoes. I wanted these shoes that were the, they were Nike Pegasus and they had an air pocket in them, and I thought they were sweet. And he's like, I'll buy you those if you go run. So I went and started running, and you know, it was kind of boring, you know, mile and a half around the neighborhood. I thought that was a lot at the time in eighth grade. And my sister and my brother, they were doing speed work, you know, and I said, I want.
And they're older?
Yeah, six years and 4 years. My brother's 6 years older, and my sister's 4 years older. And so I was like, I want to go do speed work, whatever that means. I had no idea what that means. So at, in eighth grade, I started working out with the high school, West Catholic High School's team. And, you know, the coaches noticed that I could stay with them, or I would push or grind, you know, maybe wasn't the fastest, but I was willing to compete and try to stay with the group. And I think there's a part of that you have to have, you know, a little bit of that intuitive nature of wanting to be there, you know? And so I started working out with West Catholic and running for Holy Spirit, my eighth grade team, and in track. And I ran a 501 and competed against one other kid. And it was like a back and forth all season. This kid, Jerry,
in what distance was that?
The mile.
You did a 501 mile
in eighth grade.
Holy smokes.
Nowadays, that's not even fast anymore. Bro. Pet, these girls are these. The eighth grade girls now are running 4:55. You know, it's insane.
Okay, let's pause that, because
that was 25 years ago.
I was reading your bio on your website, and I think your fastest time was a 4:02.
4:09.
Now, for context, in the senior year of my high school, when I was at my peak, I did a 4:52, and I thought I was Usain Bolt. So 4:02.
Remember,
man,
this was a long time ago. Like now they've got these shoes out. There's better coaching. The kids are in it earlier. When we did it, we just weren't doing it right, you know. But I mean, so there's a big difference. Sean, how old are you?
I'm 43.
You're 43. I'm 40.
Yeah.
So we're talking 30 years ago almost. 29, 28.
So you think a lot goes into the shoes and a lot goes into the coaching?
Well, it's
like
all,
it's not just that natural ability.
It's all, well, it is. You got to have genetic talent, I think. But there's a lot of kids who are just hardworking kids who ended up making it. You know, I wasn't the most talented. There were kids if your fans are familiar, I grew up the same class as Dathan Ritzenhine and Alan Webb. They were in the same class. They were the rock stars of distance running when I was younger. So I was sort of like in the shadows looking at that, saying, these guys are running 14 minute 5Ks in high school and I'm just trying to break 16. So it was like a mindset thing. All right, I got to at least get in the 15s, you know? And, you know, I think that it's just this shift of the mindset is like what's considered fast now, and kids are striving for that. So when we're young and we're like, we think 5 minute mile is the thing to break, well, what do you go after? You go after the 5 minute mile. But if you think 4:30 now is the thing to break, these eighth graders and freshmen and sophomores are like, well, I'm gonna break 4:30 because in order for me to win the state title and when I'm a junior senior, I gotta be running under 4:20 or 4:10 even, you know? So, you know, wherever you are, the bar is set to a standard, and then the standard is gonna be chased. And I think that's the beautiful thing about distance running, is it can work on micro levels of local clubs and groups all the way up to the national level, and it never really stops. And at some point you have to be realistic about your goals too, right? So when we're younger, we just do what our coaches tell us. You know, you probably thought, well, 4:54 was fast, and it is. It's not that it's not fast, it's just that there's a whole level of kids above you that you have to learn. And nowadays it's so transparent with Instagram. And
yeah, everybody knows
what's going on. So like, I think that's another, you say, well, what's the defining factor? It's Instagram, it's shoes, it's coaching, it's, I know what that kid's running, I want to beat him, I'm going to go run more mileage. But that's where you got to be careful too, because kids will overtrain if they're too young, you know? So
yeah,
I just got into a babbling.
No, I love it. And I want to, in a little bit, get into the overtraining and competition and everything, but yeah. Let's stick to the
the beginning stages there.
Yeah.
So you run this extremely fast mile for an eighth grader. Was that the seed that really sprung you into the next realm of running thought?
It's not that I loved running at the time. I loved competition.
Tell me about that. What was it about the competition as a young person that got you fired up?
Well, you get good feedback, all right? You have positive feedback. You realize this is something you're good in. So you have high school coaches. You have the high school team was coming. Oh, dude, come run for us. You know, you have a purpose. Everybody in this life wants a purpose, right? And so when you're young like that, all of a sudden you feel like, wow, this is something that is a driving force for me to want to go do. And running is hard. So when you're young and you feel lots of pain, I mean, are you driven towards that? Are a lot of kids driven towards the pain? I don't know. You know, I mean, you talk to another kid, they might give you a different result. But I think that a lot of young kids are driven towards positive reinforcement in a certain area. And so that's why it's so important in athletics, whether kids are the worst or the best, is to give them positive reinforcement about what they're doing, and then constructive reinforcement, right? How do you get better? You know, some kids aren't, you know, they're still in that stage of, am I good at this? Or is this something I love to do or want to do or be part of, being a part of a team? That's what we try to develop at our youth program, is just making it fun, because running's not always fun, you know? But running, like if you and I went out for a run, like we could probably chat the whole time and we could run, we could feel good, exercise, and we could probably get a lot out of each other just having a good conversation, talk about our kids and all that stuff. So like that's what drives people towards the, you know, this athletic endeavor, you know, and so that's why it's such a great sport for all around. So,
and when you got into high school, what was that like for your career? Who were the coaches? What did they instill in you at that age that you know, got you then to college?
Yeah, I would say, admittedly, in high school, I was a little bit more of a selfish athlete. I could look back and say that I had spurts of being part of a team, but I was one of the top kids as a freshman. And the coach was sort of on his way out there. He's like a legend at West Catholic. By the time I was a senior, my dad and another guy, Dennis Scully, they sort of took over and were like, this is what you're going to do. And that's really what I needed. I didn't need to be the driving force of my training in high school. I didn't know enough. But that's what I wanted to do. I was more like, do I really want to do this? I had years that I stunk because I wasn't willing to put the work in, wasn't disciplined enough, dedicated enough, a little too cocky. And I paid the price, because when I went to state meet when I was a junior, I got 130th place. You know, like.
And you didn't like that?
Oh, no. That I needed that, because I was like, I just want to get back to state because I want to be on the stage. But then when you go to the stage, because I went as a freshman, I missed as a sophomore, went back as a junior. When you get on the stage and you realize you're a nobody in the middle of the pack, you're gonna kick yourself in the ass and say, okay, no. This is, if I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna be better than that, you know? So when I was a senior, the attitude, a lot of the things changed. Maturity kicked in. I was like, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna be a leader on my team. And I ended up getting fourth at the state the next year.
Wow.
And running 15:48 as a senior. And then ran 4:22 in the miles in track. You know, I started getting to the point of, hey, let's get together here. Let's get this together. You know, let's do what I'm supposed to do, not necessarily what I want to do, and not necessarily what my ego wants me to do. Right? It's starting to shut that ego out. You know.
What were the things you did? Like,
Got up. I would get up 3 days a week and run 3 miles to 4 miles in the morning in Michigan. It's 2 degrees outside. A all-state. University of Michigan wrestler, who was one of my best friends, he would drive over to my house and we'd go for a run. I'd kick his ass, he'd kick mine. We knew we were getting up. But I mean, it'd be freezing. You know, the last thing you wanted to do was get up and run. So I did morning runs 3 days a week. I did structured workouts. I stuck to the routine, lots of plyometrics. It was just a shift, almost like when you see, like, you remember in Rocky when he got real cocky and he was like, all the cameras were around him in the stage, you know, remember that?
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, then he goes out to like the middle of Russia and like goes into a shack and trains.
Yep.
Like that was like the shift. If I could put a picture on it, it was like, hey, I'm a good runner, da da da. No, you're not. You suck. Get over here and do this.
God. It sounds so important.
It's just sometimes you have to just, somebody's got to tell you, you need to do better. Do better or you will not be better, you know? And it's, and I still, to the day, I mean, I did my best, but there were still levels and levels and levels of kids above me. When I ran 1548 at state, I think Ritzenhain ran like 1420. I mean, he was like the star, you know? So you can do all the work in the world, still not going to be the star, you know? And, but you can do it for yourself and do it for your team and do it for your future, you know? And so, and it ended up being my future, my coaching future, you know? It all was instilled of this is hard work. This is what it takes, you know? So.
But back to your wrestling friend, speak to the accountability of the getting up early with the other person.
We still talk about it. His name's Tony Gregorczyk. And when I was a sophomore in high school, I actually got up on a morning run and I got jumped. I got the shit beat out of me on a run. I had my Walkman on and these guys were behind a bush and they were drunk and they were college and they blindsided
up from the night before probably.
Yeah, so my dad, post heart attack. My dad had a heart attack when he was in mid-40s. Kind of instilled the running in us, which is why we all became runners, because we had to change our lifestyle. Again, one of those shifts of eating Kentucky Fried Chicken every day to, no, you're all going to run. We're going to eat healthy. We're going to change your lifestyle. So that was a big thing for our family. But he started getting up, and he's like, I'm not doing this. So, you know, I started running again, and I wasn't afraid when I was a senior. But, you know, when you get your ass kicked, it's kind of,
yeah, you never forget humbling. That.
You don't forget that, you know? And, you know, so Tony got up and it was good for him. It was good for me, you know? And so when we finally got to our senior year, you know, we just became really good friends because we did that, you know? And I could call him right now and be like, dude, remember those morning runs? You know, he'd be like, yeah, man. He's in a low voice, you know, he lives in Chicago now. So yeah, man, those were huge. And that's, it's funny that as I'm sitting here talking about that, but that's kind of our adult program, you know?
And I was going to go there next. Yeah. The people who sign up for your adult program, they get there in the dark and they pretty much finish in the dark in the wintertime. And that's super hard for people to do. Currently I'm on a program where I'm getting up at 4:30 and swimming, and I wouldn't do that unless my buddy, I didn't think he was going to be in the parking lot waiting for me. You know, I could just easily hit that alarm button and go back in. But, yeah, having training people is key. So your college career, tell us more about the college years and the events, the aspirations.
Mm-hmm. College was a game changer. I went to Eastern Michigan. It was culture. Running was culture there. Like, it just another big shift, right? The very first run I ever went on was with my team, and I was dead last on a 10-mile easy day by a mile. Like a wake-up call, big time. Summer training that I did that summer was not enough to keep up with the Eastern Michigan team. We ran this loop called Gallup Park, which goes to Ann Arbor and back. And I mean, Coach had to wait for me on the bike. I think he regretted the recruitment at the time on that run. He's like, oh my God, did I recruit this guy? You know? But the story changes like three months later, where, you know, the guys on the team were real supportive. They liked me. I was a team player. But I legitimately remember asking some of my teammates, like, you know, how do I do changes? Oh, dude, don't worry about it, man. Just stick in it, stay with it, stay at practice, and, you know, eventually, you know, you're gonna catch back up. You're gonna catch up. So 3 months later, we're doing a 4-mile tempo run on the track at Reinerson Stadium in Ypsilanti. And we go through the 5K in 15:35. Through in a tempo. And it hit me right there that I was, as a freshman, 3 months into college, ran a 5K PR within a workout. And that's when I was like, this is another level, right, of training. And once again, you looked at right down the street, University of Michigan had some of the top runners in the country. We had some of the top runners in the country. And I was just in the mix, man. And through college, I think my best placing on the team was fifth. I scored in a few meets and a few cross country races. And that was my place, but I ended up being a captain. So, you know, that was my place, was to be a scorer when I could be and a captain. And there were guys who were super duper talented that worked hard. And college was the bonding experience of running, but it was very difficult to manage school, to stay, you know, wanting to grind pretty much the entire year from August through May. You were grinded. Went from cross country to indoor to outdoor. It never stopped.
So cross country mixed with track. The same people did the...
They do, yeah. Cross country was all the distance guys. Then everybody would move to indoor track. And then everybody would move to outdoor track. You know, and so indoor track was probably my favorite because cross country is just different. It's just a great sport. But indoor track was real loud, real exciting. You know, all the conferences had indoor track, so we'd go travel and compete. You know, and there was a lot of camaraderie indoors because it was more close quarters. Outdoor track, you know, like we're talking right now, we're walking quarter miles. It's huge, you know, you got teams scattered all over the place. It's not quite as loud, but, you know, that was the experience. We had a great team. We had a very close team. We'd go out and party. We'd travel together. We would do relay races across the state of Michigan. We made it fun. That's what I remember about my college experience, how fun it was. I could talk to all my teammates right now on a text thread, and we would tell stories all day long about college running. And yeah.
Beautiful. And what were you studying?
Phys ed and science. I wanted to be a teacher, and I liked science, and I liked PE. So I kind of do that now.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
If I were to go back, I would take business. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of the first years trying to figure out business here. You know, I'm sure you could probably attest to that too. Just learning the ins and outs of taxes and business.
Still
and
learning.
Accounting. Right. Right. But I mean, when I first started, I was like writing stuff in a notebook, like trying to record my expenses. Like, I mean, I didn't know I was going to do any of this in college. So, and you know, when I graduated, we were in a deep recession in 2006 or seven.
Yep.
And,
I think, 2008 was when it hit.
Yeah. 2008. Yep. Yeah. And there were just no jobs. There were no teaching jobs, you know, and that was sort of the inspiration to do what I wanted to do and figure it out. And I moved, you know, 850 miles away from Michigan, and I didn't want to fail, you know?
Yeah. Well, tell us about that decision and how you went from Michigan to here in Wilmington. It's such a distance. And how'd you figure it all out? What was your inspiration there?
Buddy of mine, Tim, was in the Coast Guard here, and he just told me to come down and visit, you know, and that was pretty much the selling point. I was 22 and I could do whatever I wanted to.
And you're 22, so, and it's 2006 or seven or eight?
Six.
Yeah,
I moved here in August of 2006. So, and it was just more of a change. I couldn't believe I could move out of the state of Michigan. Like, I just, that's where I grew up.
That was your world,
right?
Yeah.
That's my world. But now, it was the best decision ever. I mean, North Carolina is just a state that is exploding in commerce and in tourism. And it's just, Wilmington's, look at what's happened in Wilmington.
Oh, it's insane.
Years. You know, 17 years is...
So were you, yeah. Annette, your wife, were you with her at this point?
We were together, but, you know, we began to separate a little bit. You know, she lived there, I lived here. And, you know, that doesn't work.
Oh, really? So yeah. She didn't come with you?
No, not
initially. You moved,
yeah,
and you're like, hey.
It took about a year and a half to 2 years.
Holy moly, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it was kind of a tough time because, like, I was living the Wilmington life,
and
she's still in college.
You're not. You're taking. This is your break period before the flyer at the.
Yeah, that
at the
was
race.
A year. That was about a year later.
Okay.
Where 2007 is when I started WL. So 2007.
Okay. Yeah. So when you first stepped foot in this town, what was your reaction? Like, what did you see? Where did you go? What was the first place at the beach you went to? Like, the first beach access I'll never forget. Walking on the south end.
You want to know where my first experience was?
Yeah.
It was at the Carolina Beach, the north end of Carolina Beach. We drove a truck out.
No
there.
Doubt. And that blew your mind.
Blew my mind that you could drive a vehicle on the water. That's where I lived. I lived down by like Ashley High School, like on the south side of New Hanover County. I wasn't even in the mix of the Wrightsville Beach scene or any of that. I just heard Wrightsville Beach was like the place to go where, you know, like it's real popular, but we didn't live anywhere near here, you know? So I started working at Gold's Gym, which is now O2 Fitness. So I got into triathlon.
The one there on
Racine?
Yeah.
So I got into triathlon, you'll like this, because I couldn't afford gas to put in my car to drive.
So you got the bike.
So I got a bike and I started driving on Masonboro Loop Road.
Dude.
Busy road, you know? Masonboro to Greenville Loop. Greenville Loop cut through UNCW's campus. That's when I first saw campus. And good morning, gents. And so I would ride back and forth one direction, and I would drive back and forth the other direction, and just to save money.
Then so I what was your first bike there?
Oh, I just had a, I can't even remember. It was a road bike. If you name the brand, I could probably, not a Diamondback, but it was something like that.
So you never really thought about triathlon at that point?
No, but I knew they were big here.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I heard about the YMCA try, and I went and watched it the first year I was here.
What year was that?
2006. That September is the first time I came and, like, watched a triathlon.
Wild.
Right when I moved here.
I did that one in 2006,
Beach.
Yeah.
I went down there, but I had no idea where I was. Military cutoff was still a two-lane road, and it was, like, just didn't know much, you know? And so, you know, that when you move here and you're not really in the main heart of the county, but then I got into the road race scene, you know, and that was sort of the
road races in biking.
No, like
running
road races. Ran like the bridges downtown.
Right.
One of my first races, I think it was called the Historic Wilmington Foundation 5-miler, everything was foreign to me here. Just I didn't know anything, you know. Just tried to do every road race I could just to kind of get my name out there in the personal training world, you know, because I was a personal trainer. So
yeah,
like, that was my first job. I hated it.
In the gym.
Yeah. I'm not a gym guy.
You're not a weight guy.
I'm not a gym guy.
Yeah.
No. I'm not like an inside. Get me outside and let's do push-ups on the beach. Let's do running on the beach. Let's swim in the water. But inside the gym. No, but
yeah.
I did it, you know, because I had to work, you know. But I also met some of my first clients there, you know. So I mean, it all works out, you know. So
for context, then after that first flyer race where I met you, the following year, I think you came in so hot to that sprint triathlon, right? Like you, I think you
might remember it differently than me, but I mean, go ahead and tell me how you.
Well,
remember.
I remember Wistoff. He was hot at the time.
Oh, yeah.
He was doing, yep. Matt Wistoff. Shouts out.
Yep.
He was a pro triathlete,
yep.
And the best in this town. So I think he won it, but you weren't far behind.
Well, here's the great thing. The first triathlon I ever did here was the Azalea Tri. Okay.
Yeah, the one here where they do it in the pool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the transition was right over here. We're actually behind it, right over there by the tennis courts. And I get in there, and I'm number one. Why am I number one in my first try? No idea. So I signed up, and I put my 100-meter time in, you know, for the pool. And I put my best 100-meter time in because I swam in high school. So I thought it said put your best 100-meter in. So I did. I put in, like, 102. But I couldn't swim 102 for 300.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So they gave me number one. And all these guys, you know, that you could tell they're in the circuit. I have no idea who they are.
Yeah.
But they're all looking like, who the hell is this guy?
Scoping the bodies out for the swimming.
So then my heart rate went way
so
up.
So you started out with a sprint in the pool.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
gassed.
I knew I was screwed at that point. I'm like, here we go. I'm gonna get just wrecked in the pool, and my mind was already in the wrong place. But I'm gonna catch them all on the run, you know. So I gassed myself so hard in the
pool.
Were
you getting passed in the pool?
I got passed twice, so I held on okay, but then I got passed a ton on the bike because I didn't have aero bars or anything. I just got on my bike, you know? And I was probably, I don't know, 20th. And then I'm like, all right, let's go bust out at sub 16, you know? And I could barely break 18.
Because you already toasted.
I'd never done a try. I didn't know how my legs were gonna feel.
Amazing, man.
So this is like 2007. And so I did catch people. I think I got like 12th or 11th in the first try. And then I signed up for, I passed on the Boston Marathon to sign up for the White Lake Half instead. So I did my first half Ironman of White Lake.
Coming up in 2 weeks now.
Yeah. And, you know, it was humbling experience. Again, I did it without aero bars or wheels, and all these bikes are passing me that have all this gear.
And this is your first open water triathlon.
Yep. Yep. And I got demolished in that too.
How was that swim for you?
Terrible.
Yeah.
Different. Swimming for me. I did swim 1 year in high school, but it was like the 50s and the 100s. Swimming took 2 years. Dave Sokka, you remember Dave Sokka?
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Legend.
Dave, awesome coach here, swim coach.
Swam under Dave Allen.
Yep. Dave's great. So him and I came up, like, we were competitors at first.
Yep, I remember
like,
this.
I had heard through the grapevine that he was, like, talking smack about me and that he was going to beat me in this.
Sick.
You know, so we didn't really know each other, but then we got to know each other. Me, him, and Wistoff got to know each other. We started finally getting smart and training together.
Yeah.
Got it, put our egos aside. And but Dave and I were like, okay, let's work together, right? So I'm going to help you with your run, and you're going to help me with my swim. And that's what we did. He helped me with my swim for like a couple months straight. I helped him with his run. I think he finally broke 16 in the 5K, which is big for him. And then I got these cues from him that made a lot of sense. Him and my brother-in-law and Kristen all
formed
form, because it wasn't fitness.
No,
you know, it was like, that's what people don't realize in the pool. Like, you can, like, you can be the fittest guy possible, but you know,
it's how you position your body, how you position your hands.
So I finally got that down, and then I got the 70.3 distance swim under 28, and that's when things changed. What's up? How you doing, coach? Good to see you.
I got to catch up with you or something.
Yeah, do it. Let's do it after this.
Yeah.
And you know, like when you're swimming 70.3, if you come out of the water in the back half, you're like, what are you going to do? You're screwed. So that started changing my ability to place well in triathlon. And I got hooked for a while. You know how it goes. The story goes, you get hooked.
100%.
But then you realize you have two directions you can go. You can keep training, could have gone pro, all this stuff. But I decided, backing off, I got married, started this, growing this. I had the races, the Wilmington Marathon, Southern Tour, these events that started growing. So the business was growing, and the athletics were starting to be like, okay, I gotta put that aside for a sec, you know? And in 2010, I had a heart ablation. So,
wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it was just, and who knows? Could have been from being an athlete, could have been from the stress of trying to get all this stuff started. But I haven't had a problem since, but still.
How did you know about that?
My heart rate went up to 230 on the bike.
Wow. On training?
Yeah. Yeah. It did it like three times. And then like I went to the ER cause I thought I was like, something's wrong. I don't feel good. I don't feel right. And I know my body pretty good.
And you saw this on your heart rate monitor.
Yeah. Yeah, and Kristen Smith was with me, and she took my pulse and be like, dude, your pulse is all over the place. Like, you probably want to get this checked. But like during that period, that was like 2010 to 2012, and I did compete in triathlon after that. And I went to Worlds in the 70.3 and was top 40 in the
I remember overall. Well, when you were doing that, it was super impressive and inspiring.
Yeah, but then after that, it's like, all right, you've gotten to here. You can take it to the pro level. but you can also focus on your business. Is this really going to make a difference? And that's where, you know, we started talking about having kids, and business and coaching people was like really where my passion was. It wasn't necessarily always training myself. You know, I wanted to coach other people. And so, yeah, the hiatus, I took a break and then did more running again, and then came back to tries in the mid-2015s. That's when I got DQ'd in the half. Remember?
Tell me about that.
When I came back to triathlon, the Ironman bought the Beach to Battleship here.
Yes, yes.
And you know, our normal course, which you know,
yep,
is you swim from Blockade Runner or Hanover Seaside Club, and you swim straight to Sea Path. So in my eyes, like, well, nothing's changed. I didn't read the athlete guide. I didn't read anything. I just went and did the race I know to do, you know, because I'd done it before. And I swam right past a new turn buoy that they put in. And a jet ski came over to me, and they're like, "You're off course, you know, like, get on course." So I'm like, "What? Off course? What are you talking about?" Like, you know, yeah. I kind of gave him like a, "What are you talking about, man?" Yeah. Like, they started me in the back, you know, because it was by age group, and the goggles are all foggy. Sun's coming up, you know, you're sighting into the sun. There's waves. There's people. I'm swimming all over these people, and I get back in the jive, you know, in the funnel, and I finish, and I won the race. And then 2 hours later, I mean, I had a great, I was stoked. I was on beer two at that Dock Street Oyster Bar downtown. And I get a call. They're like, "Are you Tom Clifford?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Yeah, this is one of the judges for the Ironman North Carolina, and we're going to have to disqualify you." I'm like, "For what?" He's like, "You skipped the swim course."
Dang.
So I was like, "You got to be kidding me." And so I was looking up all these videos, and like they said, like, don't go around the buoy, don't worry about the buoys. And they did, but they didn't backtrack on that. And so I went through a period of kind of like PO'd. I was a little pissed at myself and, you know, just at the situation. And I was like, okay, we're going to go back and we're going to do it again. And so
the following year.
So I went back.
Redemption.
Did it again. Started first. It was one of those races where you dreamt about it. Like, you dreamt about, like, finishing the swim. But that summer fall was a weird summer. I went to see Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers live. And the day that we went to see Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, I lost my first dog that I, Cosmo. He's the ran with them, all this stuff. He died that night. And then 2 months later, Tom Petty died. Before like the race, it was like, you know, I'm a huge Tom Petty fan, and the no joke, like, if people actually get to the point in this podcast where they really care about my life, but in the race, I get out of the water in first. I have the best swim of my life, and in the transition, they're playing "Here Comes My Girl" by Tom Petty.
No way.
So I'm like, no kidding. That had to be planned, you know. So then I get on the bike, and I'm on 421 North, you know, 26.8 miles an hour. I'm having a great bike ride. I just feeling it, dude. Just everything's going good. Past an aid station, they're playing "Running Down a Dream."
No way.
No shit. No lie. Couldn't believe it. I'm like, this is weird. On the run, learning to fly, Tom Petty at an aid station. It's the most bizarre freaking thing, dude. And nobody was like coordinating this, I can tell you that, because nobody really knew like that story, you know, until afterwards I was able to tell it in that way. And I did like a 4:02. It was my best half and
ever,
you know. Yeah, it was the last time I did. I did another half in Michigan just to try to come back in 2021 after COVID. But I just didn't, I wasn't like mentally, like, I didn't want to do it. So I did the race, but I didn't, like, I knew I was sort of like, all right, it's time to hang it up for a while. But that 2016 race was, 2016, 2017, whatever it was a one to remember. I got a newspaper article that says triathlete disqualified or local triathlete disqualified.
God.
It's great. It's a good story, you know?
Yeah. And so. Macro speaking on the concept of triathlon, for those the uninitiated, you have a sprint, you have the Olympic distance.
Yep.
Then you go to the half Ironman and then the Ironman. And yep. a lot of people are like, oh, well, aren't you always trying to get to be into the Ironman? And like when I was doing triathlon, I didn't really care much about anything past the sprint and Olympic distance, just because like I viewed my body and my attention span as one who just kind of like those fast events.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And those are actually in some ways are harder.
Because you gotta goose that engine the whole time.
There's no room for air.
Yeah.
And that was way less room for air. That was what I always commended Wistoff for. You know, if anybody knows Matt Wistoff, he was a still love the guy. I haven't seen him in a long time, but dude, he just super laid back, but he was very competitive. But that dude could transition like that. I mean, he was very good at transitions.
And so. Swimming, he was a UNCW swimmer.
Oh yeah, I mean, swimming is. Speaks for itself. He was one of the best swimmers and cyclists. The run is where I could actually beat him. And
but still, he was a great runner.
Yeah. But Wistoff, if he does listen to this, there's one Wrightsville Beach try where he was leading and I was catching him. And dude, I got the worst side stitch under my ribs. Sounds like a terrible excuse. But like, it was at Johnny Mercer's Pier and he was like 100 feet ahead of me and I was coming. I was coming hot. And the stitch, it's like, he like, told God to give me a stitch because it was debilitating. I could not catch him. I was like, no, damn it. I couldn't go, dude. It was just, I was like, I had to like open my abs and
that was a sprint.
Yeah. And you know why that happened? Probably because I was swimming as hard as I freaking possibly can. And I was still a minute behind.
Fatigued off that.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So. While we're on the subject of Wistoff, I beat him one time in a peer-to-peer, a gray listing peer-to-peer, first one. And I never swum so fast in my life to this day. I don't know what was in me, but I rank it as like my top athletic success to have beaten Wistoff in that that race. Wistoff, you're the man. Love you much.
He needs to get on this.
He's on my list. Nice. He popped up on social media the other day after 4 years of dormancy. He was cross-country skiing in the mountains.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good for him.
So speak to that from like a coaching perspective, like how, because I'm sure you get a lot of athletes that come to you and they're like, yeah, I want to do triathlon, and they might have goals. Like, how do you talk them through the concept of those distances and what their goals should be? And
yeah, the goals are all set based on obviously what they've done in the past. But I mean, you know, the big thing is how many hours a week do you have to train? And that's where you start. That's where I start with an athlete. Because triathlon can be consuming to a person's life, and it can affect family and relationships. It's gonna do that anyway if you're training, but like you gotta really kind of balance it real big. And I'm big on family, as you know, and you gotta find ways and say, okay, I can do 12 hours a week or 11 hours a week. And then we as coaches work around the hours, you know, and try to help them to not feel like this is this overwhelming thing that if I don't dedicate all this time to, I'm gonna suck, you know. And you know, it's a process. As you know, you have to race a few times. You got to get into the sport. You got
to
do some sprints.
Get to the starting line.
You got to do some Olympics. You got to be healthy. You got to realize that, you know, doing 170.3, maybe it's just a bucket list item for you, but if you want to get good at it, you got to race a lot of them. You know, and it's a lot of dedication, and they're expensive. So,
and the higher you go in terms of distance, obviously, the more time you need to put in to the training. And if you're training for a marathon, you're going to be running a lot.
Yeah, somewhat, not always. It's where the distances are. Of course, at the elite level, yes. But remember, like a marathon, you could run and finish and do well in a marathon. You know, I just had a girl break 3 hours off of 40 miles a week. That's not that much, but she's an injury prone if she goes higher than that, you know? So it's all about how you place the miles, you know? Like a 5K runner doesn't have to do 20 mile long runs all the time, you know, to get better in a 5K, but they can still be putting in 60 miles a week and spread it out during the week. So there's a lot of ways to kind of get the mileage, you know, spread out and, you know, still have the fatigue and still get that base training that you need. But you know, miles per week now there's some questions over some of these top athletes doing lots of cross training, you know, in between their workouts and taking that stress off the joints and the body and the injuries, and so they're lasting longer. And So there's been success with that. You know, that kind of.
So you're saying less weights?
No, I'm saying less running.
Less running, yeah. less volume.
Yeah, it's just there's like the top girl in the country right now, Parker Valby, I think her name is. And she's running like 30, 40 miles a week. I don't know that exact number, but based on some of the videos I've watched, and cross training in between to stay injury free. And she's using the benefits of today's technology and cross training to simulate running without the pounding, you know?
So is 30 to 40 miles a week not a lot?
No, not for an elite athlete, runner, but it's again about the volume, right? Volume that you're putting in that's similar to running. So if she might be putting in still 12, 13 hours a week or 14 hours a week, who knows what that number is. So the volume still might be the same, but the amount of actual miles, easy miles, is not. And you know, if you look at, okay, if you put her at 70, 80 miles a week, but she gets injured, what's the point? But if she's running 30 or 40 miles a week and then is able to be consistent and perform well, which she is, breaking records, just broke the 10K record, and the 5K record, I mean, that's kind of speaks for itself. And of course there's genetics there, you know, but if you're a really hard worker and you're going to put the work in and you're seeing results and believing in your system, then you can't really deny
that. Now you say, you put know? The hard work in, and that's something that in my own personal past, it's like, I find almost there's a fine line between overtraining and I guess not training enough and finding that balance. How does one find the balance?
Yeah. Well, stress is stress, right, John? When you're going through a lot of stuff in your life, how does training fit into that, right? As opposed to when you're not as busy, if that happens, you know, with you. So like you have a free 12 weeks, right? You're able to sleep in a little bit more. You're not quite as, their obligations are down. Well, you could probably fit more time for training in there. Stress and cortisol is like a glass of water, right? So if you can keep that glass from spilling over the top, you know, whether you've got life stress, maybe you're an accountant, right? And you go through tax season. Are you going to train for a marathon through tax season if you're an accountant? That's a great analogy, because probably not. It's probably not a good idea. That accountant's working overtime. They've got all the taxes due for all the companies they're doing the accounting for. If they added a marathon on top of that, that would be like the glass, you know, spilling over the top tenfold. Whereas maybe the accountant's less busy season is in the fall, you know, and so they maybe could do a marathon during that time of the year and not be as stressed and keep that glass below the lid line, you know. So I think that's how you find balance. You got to be realistic. You got to talk to somebody like who knows what they're doing, how the effect the training is going to have. And then when you're in your busy times of the year, you can still train and be ready to amp it up. Maybe doing 50 to 60%, but then when you're ready to go, you have a starting point. That's not zero. So it's not all or none in endurance sports. I think a lot of people will think all or none. You know, I'm either going to train and I'm going to do my best, or I'm not going to do it at all. You know, and I think that's the wrong attitude, because you can always be in a little, you know, and be doing stuff all the time to advance. You know, I think that's one thing I'm able to do, or what have been happy with besides the year I had a surgery done, was I've stayed very consistent since college. I really haven't stopped. You know, I've always been trying to be in the sport, and I'm always doing some kind of challenge each year. And that's helped me stay in a place where fitness is able to be gained from a point that, you know, is it's like a starting point that you're kind of almost there, right? But in order to get that last 20, 30, 40%, that's where the hard training comes in. But I'm not coming from zero. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And you're almost keeping a maintenance level.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word for it, maintenance level. Except the year I had a bilateral sports hernia surgery, it was pretty bad. In 2020 was the year, of course, which is probably not a bad year because there were no events going on. But that's when I really had to start from scratch. I started after that surgery, I had to just do like a mile walk for 2 weeks and build up to running over time.
How, you know, how was that for your ego? Because I found when I'm injured and I can't do the things I'm doing, I have an identity crisis almost. I'm like, am I the same guy? Who am I?
Yeah. Well, ego, I've mentioned it a couple times in this talk. And, you know, ego, one real famous guy who's passed, he used to say ego is edging God out. You know, so to me, I try to remember that anytime I let that get to me is that the Lord has plans, you know, and I have to follow those. So whatever those are, I, you know, pray about it. If I've lost my way, and usually all the time I've gotten an answer, I feel like, you know, and I think that that time I did go through a little bit of a, like, what am I going to do if I can't run again? But I didn't, I really didn't. I really wasn't upset about that. I kind of came to, hey, look, I can, I have so many of these things I can do. I have other hobbies. I have other things that I personally can do while coaching and getting, instilling the help, but God had other plans. He gave me the ability to overcome this. And dude, ever since, I've helped people who've joined my coaching who have had major issues, you know, prior to, or they're like, hey, I can't get out of this. It's helped me to help them overcome it. And a lot, and 99.999% have overcome it. I mean, there's probably somebody in there who's still working through some stuff, but that's the point, is that I had never gone through a big setback like that athletically, you know, and that was the first big setback. And I was able to overcome it. So it taught me a lot just about the rehab and the starting from scratch and, you know, kind of how to get my diet back in check, you know, during that time. And so, yeah, man, I mean, it's all, everything happens for a reason, you know. I mean, I know it's a cliche term, but it really does. It's just hard for people in the moment to see it, but that's where you got to trust and have a little bit of faith.
And then what do you say to the people who are your clients and who you might come across that they're in those tough spots and they might go down the wrong path of eating poorly, sleeping poorly, drinking, not doing the things they need to, you know, that maybe these are coping mechanisms to mask the pain of the situation they're in. Like,
yeah.
how do you get them out of that hole?
It's hard, but you have to do things that are going to advance your physical ability. And like drinking, I love going out and having beers. You know, that's, I really enjoy it. But I know that it affects my sleep. It affects my ability to think straight, especially the next day. It's a tough conversation to have for a lot of people, but it's really, how good do you want to feel? You know, when you're not doing it, when you're not training for a big marathon or something like that, you have to be wanting to feel good just to feel good, to be able to perform in your daily life and your daily tasks, raise your kids, you know, not make mistakes, you know, to, you still go out and have fun once in a while. It's all about the balance, right? The balance of training versus not training. But feeling good is not masking it with alcohol or, you know, whatever drug that, you know, comes across the table. It's learning how to feel good and being able to overcome that without doing that stuff. And that's a problem in our country right now, is that we rely too much on drugs or something to make us feel calm or whatever it is, you know? And so, you know, I encourage people like that, that have that issue, to talk to someone, get help. But know that your athletic career is always able to do something, you know? You're always able to get in the pool and exercise or do something that involves movement that makes you feel good. So.
Yeah, you know, I too enjoy beer. And in my history, have found that like there's a line between like enjoying it a little much in the evening and then like knowing when to quit. How do you know when, like, how do you space out your weekend, I should say?
Well, it's crazy nowadays when you go back to science. We have data now called HRV data.
I pay attention to it on my watch every day.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. When you, like, I'll give you some raw numbers.
Yeah. Okay. Speak on that, dude, because it's huge.
So when I go through a week and I hydrate all week, don't touch one drink. My HRV is in the 60s, you know, maybe upper 50s. And that number means that's your space between heartbeat. You know, it's if you look up HRV in Google, you'll get a really technical answer.
And if you have an iWatch, you can look at this on a chart.
Yep.
Yep.
And so one Friday I went out and I drank, you know, I had two tropical lightnings. For anybody who's listening knows that those are strong, 7.5%. It'll kick your ass.
God's candy.
Yeah. HRV plummeted to 41 the next morning. All right. And that means that my body during sleep was under stress, was either fighting an infection or just overall did not have quality sleep, but it's showing my body was under distress while sleeping. And so therefore my recovery process and my ability for my brain, my body, and everything to recover was compromised. And that's just from doing that. What I have noticed, and on the contrary, is if I do want to go out and enjoy beers with friends, if I do it earlier in the day and then hydrate before bed, I don't get that effect. Not to say that you want to do it on a regular basis, but the clarity of your body, your mind, and everything when you don't go, when you actually give your body what it needs, water, electrolytes, amino acids, you're just going to feel better. And then look, just like anything, there's rewards. Go out and wait for a day to go out and have fun. Like, plan it. Because if it's a daily thing, it becomes not something that you can go out and look forward to, depending on where you stand on alcohol or anything. But it does take discipline. Everything in life takes discipline. Well, the minute you become undisciplined, it's because you've dialed back your own expectations for what you really want to do. You've lowered your expectations. Your discipline goes down because you don't have goals anymore. You aren't willing to sacrifice this or that because your level. I don't want to use the word motivation because I don't like that word, and I can tell you why. But your overall discipline. It's almost like, Sean, you go to the dentist, your teeth are great, you know, they're always great. You know that you haven't really been disciplined, like I'm brushing your teeth, you're like, I'm not gonna brush my teeth anymore, like, my teeth are always great, you know? But then one year, you go to the dentist, and they're like, dude, you got gingivitis, man. Like, your teeth look like shit, right? And you go back home, and you're like, I better start flossing and brushing. And then all of a sudden, what do? You're disciplined before bed. Maybe you're not, maybe you don't care, but most people are gonna care. And you're gonna floss, and you're gonna get one of those $65 toothbrushes that knock all the shit off your teeth. And you become aware of something. It's almost like somebody who gets a heart attack in their 50s or 40s, what do? Life-changing event. That's what happened to my dad. But why wait for that? Figure out what you wanna do today to become more disciplined. I'm not saying it's easy to stick to, but like, you got to wake up in the morning. If you have a marathon goal or a half marathon goal or a 5K goal, are you more willing to wake up at 5 o'clock to get your runs done, to get your strength done before the day starts? That makes you more disciplined. If that's where you really want to be, or you become more disciplined because you're not happy or satisfied where you're at the moment. So if you can think, all right, if I'm not happy or satisfied right now, today, where do I need to be to get me to that satisfaction point? How do I discipline myself to get there? And we all go through these waves of like, oh man, this is hard. You know, when it gets hard is when you really got to get disciplined. That's where motivation is thrown out the window. Motivation's out. You can be sitting on the couch eating a bag of popcorn or eating a bag of potato chips and watch the Boston Marathon, and you can be motivated in the moment. Oh, I'm doing that next year, while you're nice and rested and feeling good. But then when you're in week 10 of the training, the motivation's gone, dude. You're tired, sore, you don't want to do it anymore. You know, but that's the line. That's where you become disciplined and say, this is what I have to do it. When the alarm goes off and maybe you did go out the night before, and what are you gonna do? You know, jump in an ice bath and get your ass out there, right?
100%.
I've had that conversation with these guys over here. UNC Dub.
Yeah. So let's go back to the HRV and the sleeping.
Did I just get off into a tangent?
No, I love that tangent. That's a clip right there. That was good. That was real good. Because I went through a period of poor sleep, and it totally affected me, and I got really dialed into like the sleeping thing. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your philosophy around sleep, the importance of sleep when it comes to recovery, but how that also too is a fine line, because you gotta be disciplined to go to bed early enough to get your full 7 to 8 hours, and then you also have to still wake up when that alarm goes off and do that practice that you need to do before work. So how?
Still working on it, Sean.
Yeah. It's hard. Yeah. Tell us.
Well, yeah. I mean, I have a weird schedule. It's not the normal schedule. Like, I get home sometimes at 7:30. I eat, put my kids to bed, and then it's 8:30 already. And so I gotta go to bed. But sometimes I don't. Sometimes I stay up and I'll try to get more work done. And that's not the greatest habit. But sometimes I have to. And that's where the discipline comes in. But then I also know how well am I going to work at the end of the day as opposed to the beginning of the day. So when my brain is fresh, I've slept for 7-8 hours, my productivity is going to be way higher in the morning. When I get up, fresh cup of coffee, I do some ketones once in a while, if you've heard of those. But they, are a fuel that helps fuel your brain a little bit better.
And we'll tell us more about that real quick.
Yeah, ketones, you just look them up. I mean, they're something your body produces when you're in the starvation state, but you don't take them for that. You take them for more of this energy source that is beyond glucose and your normal energies that you get from food. So, but I'll take those once in a while when I have a big productivity day. And I have to tell myself at night, okay, are you going to be more productive if you wake up at 4 a.m. and have that all going when the house is quiet, you've slept for 6 to 7, 8 hours, or are you going to be more productive by trying to get work done at night? And so I usually choose the morning. Morning's going to be the more productive time. And so, yeah, like you said, man, it takes discipline and it takes wanting to do it, and part of like going back to the drinking, which again, like, I'm not saying, I mean, anybody out there who, I'm not anti-drinking, I'm just anti-over-drinking, even though I like to go out and do it, and my college friends would be laughing at me right now, but when you go and you do too much of that, you don't think clearly, you don't want to get out of bed, like, you're foggy when you wake up, if you're like that, and you do it day after day, that shit lingers, It takes 2 to 3 days to get over drinking, And so the first 2 hours of your day are the most productive 2 hours you can have. So I like to get up early. Today I bypassed that and came here. And that's why I love this conversation, because I feel like I'm on,
Yeah, not. No, you're killing it.
But
so what on a normal day, what time do you get up?
Most of the day is 4 to 4:30.
Mm-hmm.
The days I don't have practice in the morning, 5 to 5:30, I like to get up.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, dude, I'm everyone's human, right? I sometimes don't like to set an alarm. I'm like, no alarm today, not happening. Like, and if you do day after day after day after day, alarm, 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 you'll burn out from that. You got to have days where you just don't, and you get to relax. And again, a day to look forward to, just like a vacation.
Do you do that on the weekends?
Not necessarily, no. Because like this weekend, I got to wake up early and help race Saturday morning, and then Sunday I got to wake up and run 21. It's just that's my plan this weekend. So my discipline on Friday night, tonight, and tomorrow have to be on point so I can do those things. And it's life's a balancing act, right? You got to balance what you want to do versus what you want to feel good doing. Sometimes what you want to do doesn't always want to make you feel good.
Do you take naps during the day ever?
I do. Yeah, I do 15 to 20 minute. There's an app I use called Endel, E-N-D-E-L. I paid for it. I like it because it has like these different like binaural beats, and it's crazy. the thing, the music and the sound puts you into like a subconscious state. And then when the sound changes, you come out of it naturally. You don't even need an alarm, even though I set one just in case. But you don't need an alarm. And we're going by the GCW track speaker here. And that was like sort of my what's going on with Lane 8? Sort of my like come to Jesus, like holy cow, like this stuff, beats and meditation, and we have so much technology today that we can utilize this stuff to get our minds rested a little bit. And dude, I mean, like if I do a 15 to 20 minute power nap in the middle of the day with like the binaural beats, I wake up and I feel like that productivity just went up the next hour or two, you know? And I think
And are you going into a sleep mode during this time, or is it more of a meditative state?
It depends.
How tired you are?
Yeah, like if I'm really tired, I will fall asleep for that 15 or 17 minutes. But normally I'm in this weird like twitchy state. You ever had that before? You're like all of a sudden you like feel like you're falling off a cliff, you twitch.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
But like that'll happen during that, you know, where I'll kind of come in and out. But the point is your brain needs just as much rest as your body does. And then there's just this huge, you know, synchronization between the two, how you feel and when your brain's rested. So yeah, I love exploring all that stuff. Do I know everything about it? No. I'm always listening, trying to feed off information to help not only personal growth, but when people ask, you know, every runner, triathlete that we coach, it's not the training anymore that people are really not accustomed to. Like it's been around for a long time. It's all this extra stuff. Like how do I manage all of this? How do I get through things mentally? How do I talk to myself, you know? And those are the really important parts of, I think, the athletic world, is believing in what you're doing and also having a fresh mind, you know, having a brain that, you know, is functioning the best possibly it can, because then the body's going to follow suit. You know, if you're not mentally strong, your body can't utilize its full potential, you know? So I think the mental fitness is there. And, you know, it eats me up inside to see kids, you know, you see it all over the news that there's a mental health problem. These kids have no idea, you know, how strong they really are inside and what they can do. There's just, it's limitless, dude. Like God made our brains limitless in some way, shape or form. Like we can keep learning and keep opening our ideas and taking those ideas and expanding them on themselves. And like everyone has a purpose. They just got to find it. So
speak to the breathing, on two parts. Calm breathing when you're doing your meditative state, when you're trying to calm down, and then breathing when you're in an intense running state, and how that helps you gather more steam to go harder.
It's a thing to work on for sure. I tried this breathing app for a long time and I fell off. You know, there's only so many things you can do at once, as we talked about at the beginning of this. But you know, breathing is important. Rhythmic breathing, slow breathing. Like I'm able to lower my heart rate. Like if I sat there on the couch and watched my heart rate and I took slow breaths out, I can lower my heart rate down to 39, you know, for just sitting there, and you're in a very calm and relaxed state. The hard part is when somebody is under extreme stress and anxiety, how do they teach themselves to do that? And that takes practice, but it does work. Like your breath, in being in mindfulness, Phil Jackson talks a lot about it in his book that I'm actually on right now, about how he had the Chicago Bulls do a lot of mindfulness during their championship years, you know, and how like he would have them practice without talking, you know, and he would have them do breathing exercises, and some people felt very awkward about it with moving the outer lanes, you know, at first, because it is kind of awkward. You know, not speaking, like going, you know, doing that stuff. It's sort of awkward, right? if you're like me, I like to joke around and laugh. And you hear someone like fart in a room or something, it's fun. But it works. It really works. And you know, for people who do suffer from that kind of stuff, or you know, athletes who want to learn how to breathe better in their races and control their breathing. You know, Wim Hof's a great technique. Really fun. You know, you can ice, you can do ice baths and breathe beforehand and then do an ice bath. And but again, all this stuff is, it's hard. It's hard to do. Nothing is easy. Not one thing. Like, everything takes a certain amount of mental effort to stay consistent doing. And if you aren't willing to do it, if you're going to try it for 2 weeks and then quit, you know, you're not going to get the benefits. It's like if I told somebody to go run for 2 weeks and see if you get better, you're not going to get better. You're probably going to get worse for those 2 weeks. You know, you're going to be more fatigued and you're going to feel, you're going to be sore for 2 weeks until you get used to it, you know? So it's you got to pick and choose, you know, you can only do so much, but breathing is important. All these watches now have little breath control apps on them, where you can just do 5 minutes of breathing exercises. And I'm a believer, you know. Sometimes I wish somebody could force me to do it every day. Somebody said to me, hey, let's do our breathing 10 minutes. You know, I need to be forced to do that crap too, you know.
So, what's your thought on nasal breathing and, I guess, training with mouth tape?
So I actually taught myself that back in 2010. When I was waking up with sinus infections all the time and dry mouth, I taped my mouth shut. I came across it on before it kind of got into I know today it's starting to gain some popularity, but I took blue paint, you know, tape, and I taped my mouth shut for like a week.
While sleeping.
And I don't open my mouth at night, and I haven't had a sinus infection since.
Wow.
Yep.
Did you have you ever trained with the mouth tape?
No. Nope. I might now because we got a treadmill in the garage. And I have this, I don't need mouth tape for it. I have it's called an Aero Fit or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's the breathing thing I was telling you about. And it did work. It was very hard. But again, I haven't put the time into it, you know. And it really isn't a whole lot of time. It's just actually setting aside the time to do it. But you could take that mouthpiece in a controlled environment like a treadmill, and you could set it as settings on it so the in and the out exhale is resisted. And, you know, maybe when I get past this marathon cycle, I would do, you know, maybe 30-minute runs and see how it works, you know, just controlling the breathing while running. But, you know, all that stuff needs to be monitored. You need to do it slow. Don't want to pass out or anything. But, no, I haven't gotten into the nasal breathing at all while actually doing
a run.
No, I haven't done that.
Yeah, I've seen some advertisements pop up on Instagram for mouth tape in the pool, and I'm struggling to see how you're going to breathe out of your nose in the pool. So that's pretty extreme to me.
That does seem extreme, and I don't know. I'd say there's a little bit of danger there, you know?
Yeah. So back to kind of like, let's talk about when you come across new clients and they come in with expectations. What's the battery that you run through to see how fit they are, where they want to go, and then kind of give them an idea of like, hey, you're not going to be shredded in 2 weeks. What's your without limits protocol?
Yeah, it's actually pretty laid back at first because I'm an observer. So if I get a virtual client, that's different. Somebody doesn't live here. But anybody I coach who lives here, comes to practice, the first thing I want to do is come to practice. And I want to watch how they do things in the group. Because what someone says to me on the phone isn't always actually the right thing. You know, not that they don't think they're correct, but my observation may say something completely different, you know. Especially if somebody's like, oh, well, what's your 5K? Well, I run somewhere between 24 and 25 minutes or something like that. And then I see him on the track and they're way faster than that. They just don't know how to do it, right? And so I think that there's a good 3 to 4 weeks of observation and like the getting to know you period, because you're not going to get insight and information on an athlete in a day, you know, or a week even. You know, it just takes a building relationship to have conversations, learn about what this person's lifestyle is, learn about what they do, learn about their past history a little bit more. So there's that. Yeah, it's just more of a time will tell kind of thing. But it's pretty fun right away to see someone new. They've really never done interval training, or maybe they have, they just haven't done it right. And it's when it starts to click, especially in youth kids, that's real fun. When like it starts clicking, the racing starts to click. I watched my daughter last night run the 800. She's never done the 800. She was a little nervous. We took it out lap one. I said, go out slow. And you could tell she wanted to go. Then when I saw her come through the 400 meter marker, I saw the look on her face. Like, this is hard. You know, the track's bigger on the second lap. So she goes into the second lap, and Paul, this teammate, he fell. And she like stutter stepped and wasn't sure if she should stop and help him. But then he got back up, and then he chased her down, and they went back and forth. And then she took the lead at the home stretch, and he ended up racing this other girl, and they caught her. And then she turned and looked and started racing them. And it was all like that right at the finish line. And what a cool thing to see it click, the competition part, like changing gears. And it clicked for her. She's never felt that before. How does it feel to feel lactic acid in your legs and just not be able to do it? And it, you know, hurts like a, you know. So like seeing athletes click, adult athletes come out and finish, you know, 600s, 800s, and like start to get, oh man, when I go out, the first one feels like terrible. The next one feels better. The third one feels the best. Then the workout starts, you know. But like helping them understand that when they warm up for any race, like, are they even warming up correctly? Are they even warming up? Some people aren't. They just go to the line. You know, isn't that crazy? Like, but that's when you don't grow up in the sport or in any athletics, how do you know what to do beforehand? You know, and so that's where I think we come in, and the basics are great, but then just the little tidbits of information that I've, you know, gained over 18 years of coaching people. It's just, you have all these tools in the toolbox, and you got to figure out how you're going to use them, you know, and other coaches, like the other coaches you run into and talk to that have all the knowledge in the sport too, that I've learned and learned from over the years, you know? So yeah, it's fun.
How do you, I don't want to use the word motivation, but how do you keep them from falling off?
Yeah. Set several
after those 2 weeks, yeah. And they're hurting and,
well, they usually won't fall off after that. That's when they feel like they're
doing.
Yeah, that's when we say, look, this is where they'll start to feel good, because they're probably now getting on a periodization where they're taking their proper recovery. A lot of athletes who start, at least that come to me, they're probably overtraining, you know, during the week and not taking enough recovery, you know. So I think the way we place the recovery within the program after hard weeks, they then see the benefits after a couple weeks of, oh wow, now I see when to rest and I see when to go and all these things, you know. So I think the recovery is a big piece of it too, you know. So
you mentioned your daughter. How do you approach parenting and parenting athletes? I guess, you know, I'll say from my own perspective, like, I am a surfer. I want my kids to be surfers, but I find when I push them to be surfers, it goes the other direction.
Right.
But when I kind of hold back and just allow them to make their own decisions, like, how do you approach that with running?
Same. I don't really coach. I you know, I know, you know, we're kind of that 8, 9, 10, 11. That is like the coaching phase of parenting before they start to really, you know, do their own thing. But the coaching phase in parenting is different than the coaching. I don't coach her. I mean, she goes to Brad and Ryan at practice. I'll give her some advice if she'll take it. But I always ask her, hey, can I give you some advice? Usually it's no. Usually she's like, no, I'm good, Dad. I'm good. Okay, just let me know if you need help. Especially bowling. Damn, that girl is a hard-headed girl. When she bowls, I threw it right down the lane, Dad. It was right down. I'm like, actually, you do it. Don't tell me what to do, you know. So, but my other daughter's not quite like that, but she's also younger. They're young, man. When I was 8 years old, I wasn't doing anything serious, and neither should they. If it's too serious, that young, they're not going to last. They got to do every sport they can do and enjoy it and be athletes with the running. If they wanted to be runners, be athletes with a running specialty. If they want to be soccer players, be athletes with a soccer specialty. You know, I mean, I don't really, if my kids aren't runners, whatever. I mean, that just happens to be my sport. But I'm going to get them running and swimming and doing the things that they're most likely going to do so they create the skills for it. Whether they do it or not in high school and middle school, is that's up to them, not me.
So this is a swimming water show. Yeah. Where we're talking a lot about running today.
Yeah.
Speak about how the two combo and how you find some runners that are great, insane runners, but they're not great in the pool, and vice versa. Amazing swimmers that can't run very well at all. Where's the physiological difference there? Because it seems like the cardio would transfer, you know, and they have the muscles. So what's your perspective?
Yeah, I didn't get a ton of transfer from swimming to running or running to swimming. Runners have dense legs. They sink in the water, you know? But again, if you just go back to the mechanics, right? It's all about the mechanics of each sport. If you have the swimming mechanics, you're going to be able to swim fast, you know? But the minute you add mileage to your body, you know, it does affect the swimming, right? Like I saw it when I helped Matt and Dave. The faster they got on the track and the run, the more mileage they put in, the more it compromised the swim. And some of that could have been that they weren't swimming as much. You know, they were dedicating more time onto the run. But you know, they're both great endurance sports. The periodization is similar. You can work harder in the water. Like as far as workouts and intervals go, you wouldn't train like that in running. Running, you're going out and running distance. You know, swimming, you don't typically. Did you ever go out and just swim 10K straight? I mean, besides open water.
Well,
you never did that in the pool, right?
I mean, my pool program is 4K a day. That's like.
Well, right, but I mean, but I don't ever recall hearing swimmers like just going having a distance day, like a long day. It was a long interval day, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You would do intervals in the pool on the clock or something like that, an endurance day. But I never heard of them like going out for a 6-mile swim just together, right? That's a distance thing.
Yeah.
A distance running thing where distance runners will go on their long run, 12, 14, 16 miles, right? 2 hours. But you don't really do that in swimming where, you know, that. So there's a lot more downtime in running, mileage time, because running's harder on your body as far as impact goes. Swimming is a lower impact sport. I'm not saying it's not hard on your body, it's just lower impact. You're in the water, you're not resisting gravity quite the same as you are running. So, you know, I would say, you know, that, you know, if somebody wants to be a swimmer and a runner, your mechanics in the pool and both the running and the swimming are very important, having the mechanics. But they definitely, there's like, if you look at some of the triathletes today, phenomenal in both. I mean, and they're almost being brought up that way, or they're being brought up in seeding the running and the swimming mechanics together. It's pretty amazing. You know, I mean, it took me a long time. Like even when I do this, the video, like even when I do this, I can't do a swimmer's, like, I don't have that flexibility in my arms like swimmers do. So that already physically is limiting, right? I only have so much potential as far as that goes. Maybe if I hung for a year, you know.
Do you have time for one more lap?
Yeah.
Okay, sick. Yeah, now if you're training for both, you're the coach, how do you break that up? Like, are you saying, hey, you're going to swim in the morning, run in the evening?
Yeah.
Or is that going to, like, gas you too much? What's your perspective on that?
You mean for, like, a standard triathlete?
Triathlete? Say an Olympic triathlete at a high level.
I think you have swim-focused weeks, too. You can have weeks where you really hammer the swim and get a lot more yardage in just to really amp your swim up. You can also have run-focused weeks, right, where running volumes higher and your swim volumes lower that week, and then you intermix it, you know, because in triathlon you got to go swim, then the blood has to transition to your legs and you got to get on the bike, so you got to do swim bike bricks and then bike run bricks, you know. But Swimming is always a great go-to for any of the sports to stay fit, right? Especially if you have a swimming background. Like if you're a swimmer and you grew up a swimmer, that's your thing. That's what's gonna give you confidence. So swim a lot, because if you get confidence in being fit from swimming, then that's your primary sport. You grew up with that sport. That's a sport that you that gives you that confidence and that physical ability to be fit because you know how to push in it. But then, you know, over time, hopefully the bike and the run begin to catch up and you get confidence in those too. Like for me, I'm always more confident when I run a lot. I love running mileage. I know that if I'm running and doing certain workouts, that my level of fitness in the run is there. That's where I'm talented the most in. But yeah, swimming, you know, I'm not a fan of pool swimming, to be honest with you. I like being able to listen to it. Now you can listen to music, but I like seeing things, going on adventures. So I like open water swimming a lot more. With me and Cam got into swim run. You know, that's been a fun sport to do because you're like running through the woods and then you come out and you pop in the water and you swim across something. Like at Riceville Beach, we can swim across the channel, you know, 500 down, get out, start running again. So you're swimming with your shoes on. It's pretty sweet.
Let me tell you why I love pool swimming so much.
Yeah, go.
I go to a pool every day and I've been doing it solid for 12 years now. And
yeah,
it's like a place where I can put everything aside. Yep. No music, no distractions, just staring at that black line. And it is a deep meditation in that you can just focus on the breathing. And for me, the pool is where the breathing is so magical, because you don't have to think about a wave hitting you. You can really, you know, maybe breathe every 4 or 5 strokes if you want. Or if you're hustling, breathe every other stroke. And the flip turns, God, the flip turns are so good. When you don't bounce off that wall like a dolphin. But that's my tangent on the pool.
Dude, and that is probably a lot of people's, you know, swimmers, that's what they love. And that I'm all in. If you like that, for me, I flip turn and I'm like, I wonder if that looked like a seal, you know, like making a giant splash in the water. I can do it a little bit better now. Yeah, then I come up for air like flip turn, you know.
Yeah,
it's so funny because I have such a strong lung capacity, but it's all about, like you said, being calm. And I remember when I was training a lot in the pool, that when I would do a flip turn, if I was very calm and relaxed, that I was able to hold my breath a whole lot longer, you know. And one time I did a swim, exactly what you just said, and I was like, I was a little stressed, and I actually did like a prayer back and forth. And I would only breathe once every 25, but I tried to swim 2,000 straight like that, breathing once every 25, and just see if I could do it. And I did it, and it was really hard sometimes, but it kept me very, like, you know, relaxed and floating on top of the water and slowing things down and not trying to always be thrashing. So I can concur.
So speaking to VO2 max, they say that's how you can increase your VO2 max by doing that very, very thing you're talking about.
Yep.
The holding of the breath. Whereas in running, you don't really hold your breath while running.
Correct.
So speak to what you know about VO2 max and increasing it, and how, again, back to the swimming and to the running, from your experience, how having a high VO2 max helps in those two arenas than just endurance athletics generally.
Yeah, VO2 obviously is a zone, you know, heart rate zone too, where you're actually training at like your 2 mile pace and running. And in swimming, you can do it by hypoxic efforts, also by hard efforts too. You know, basically your body's hypoxic of oxygen. You're above zone 4, you're above threshold, you know, so you're at like the, I would say like the NASCAR spot, you know, really revving the engine up. It's just harder on your body in running, right? When you do VO2 intervals, you can't be repping, you know, a high amount of volume at that, you know, depending on the athlete's miles per week. But you can get a huge advantage of doing VO2 type intervals over, you know, maybe at the peak part of your training, over like a 7 mile tempo run, which can be harder on your body repetitively than a VO2 can. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So you gotta place those workouts right in your training plan. You gotta place them where right when you start getting into the peak of the volume, like peak of your training cycle, maybe you're 6 to 8 weeks out from your big races or your, you know, your state championships or your marathon or whatever it is, and you start hitting those type of reps, and yeah, they're harder on your body. They're gonna put more strain on your body. But that's how you increase it. And as you know, you can't hold that fitness year round. You know, you gotta go through spells of recovery period where you're not doing the hardest of the intervals all year. Because when you do, stuff will break down. I don't know exactly how VO2 is increased, like what the protocol would be for hypoxic, you know, swimming, and how necessarily, I would assume that would definitely help your oxygen, you know, to be able to, you know, hold your breath holds. I can't remember what it is now. It's called, it was something I was working on where the amount of oxygen you can hold in your lungs, lung capacity, right? So I know that will help that a lot. But yeah, as far as like actually measuring your VO2 max through hypoxic, I'm not positive.
Is that something you do with your athletes or that you've done yourself?
Well, I mean, I measure based on their a 2 mile time trial or a 5K, not necessarily a marathon or a half, because too many variables in that.
Mm-hmm.
Heat could be a variable, length could be a variable, you know, race execution could be a variable. Whereas when you run a 2 mile, there's not a whole lot of room for error there. You know what I mean?
We should be.
So we can measure their base fitness based on a 5K or a 2 mile because of, you know, it's a shorter distance, it's where their talent is. You know what I mainly find a lot of times is a 12 minute test or a 5K run will tell me more about the athlete's potential than anything else, right? If they go out and run a 3:30 marathon but they can run a 21 minute 5K, you know, I mean, they might be able to be a lot faster than the marathon. They just have to learn to become fatigue resistant. They have to learn how to build some of these things up to get their potential out of the marathon. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So you say the 5K is a great place to judge yourself.
It's an easy, it's a much easier, it's much easier to run a 5K because there's way more 5Ks. You're not seeing 2 mile races all over the place, you know, but a true VO2 max test, I believe, is about 12 minutes. You know, 12 minutes all out. So if you can run 12 minutes all out in 14 minutes, or I'm sorry, in 2 miles, so that's 6 minutes a mile, then your quote unquote VO2 pace or your VO2 max pace slash heart rate is 6 minute pace. So come through lane one. So does that make sense?
Totally.
Yeah. So, you know, you can kind of do that and measure, get a pace down. But then that may change if it's 90 degrees and humid, because the heart rate's going to be higher when that happens. You're not going to be able to get as much oxygen in your body because there's more humidity in the air. And there's all kinds of variables when it's 55 degrees and cool as opposed to 90 degrees and humid like it is in southeastern North Carolina, you know. So, yeah. So it's all about kind of reading those, taking people through those cycles, microdosing them with intervals that are going to challenge their bodies, but not so much that, you know, they're going to overtrain or get hurt. That's the goal, right?
Yeah. Now let's shift back to you personally. You know, you're 40 years old. 40 is for me, you know, I'm 43 now.
Yep.
When I was 40, I thought I was going to go into my 60s feeling like I was 30. So how is here at 40, how are you coping with it physically? I saw you running a couple weeks ago. Man, you're a horse still. You're still just killing it. How do you feel though? And how do you set your expectations? And where's your psychology?
The only thing I feel differently is I can get more achy after hard workouts. You know, just like I gotta focus a lot on recovery, but my mindset still thinks I'm 20s.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I'm like, I don't want to break 15 minutes in 5K.
Yeah.
I'm 40. You know, and just to prove that I can do it, you know. And I've trained with these guys, repping stuff out with these guys. I know that I'm older, doesn't feel like it, but then when I talk to the young guys, I'm like, wow, it's been 20 years, holy cow.
Yeah.
But I did just run 15:02 in the 5K, and I feel good, man, you know, but I definitely have aches and pains that I have to be careful of. If I don't keep up with my core and my hips, and I feel things that can break down easily, you know, when you neglect that stuff. Like even this morning, I'm driving here thinking, man, maybe I need a day off. I haven't taken one in a while, and my body's beating up.
And that means nothing.
Yeah, nothing. I'm walking, stretching and core.
Yeah.
Walk.
You know, yeah, walking's walk. Always fine, right?
Yeah, I would do core work. I would do something, just no endurance training. No repetitive training, you know what I mean? And I think that when you're in your 40s and you're doing this stuff, you have to be okay with that. If you're not okay with that, then you're going to get hurt, you know, and overtrain. But yeah.
I want to go, you know, cuz I'm 43. I got all winter I've been training for this lifeguard trial, and it's kind of like my thing, right? I've won it 10 times over my 30s, and I'm like, I'm 43, can I still do it again?
Yes.
And I've been training all winter hard for it.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not this Sunday, but the following Sunday. I'm feeling a little bit fatigued. How do you think, from a coaching standpoint, should I approach the next week? As far as volume, resting, what would you tell me?
I think you've been training hard, you should be feeling fatigued at this point. And inside 10 days, you're not really going to make any gains. So I think between now and the 10 days out, you know, you could push it hard. You know, don't hurt yourself, but push it hard.
Still work out.
Oh, yeah.
Really? Okay.
You put the last icing on the cake in this last, you know, what? You got 5 days?
No. You have
5 days until 10 days out.
Exactly.
Yeah. So for the next 5 days until that 10 day out marker, which would be like the next Wednesday. Right?
No. The day, the race would not be this Sunday, but the following Sunday. So 7 days would be Sunday.
Oh, 7 days.
We're about 10 days.
So you're about 10 days out. So today, maybe your last big day, and then start to slowly bring it down, and then make sure you get a couple of days off next week, and you know, maybe two out of those days, but stay
so
sharp.
So how about what about the day to 2 days before the big event? Are you
I like to do like 3 days before. So if the event is Sunday, you said?
Yep.
Yeah. So Saturday and Friday, you would train. Thursday, you would take off. So then Friday, you're doing some prep. Saturday, you're doing some prep. But short, you know, like 30 to 45 minutes. But if you do too much off beforehand, you can feel stale on the day of the competition.
Yeah.
So almost like you're here. You're fatigued, your fatigue is hot. You initially go into rest, your fatigue is low, but you sort of feel like junk a little bit when you start resting. And then you really rest, and then you bring your fitness around those last 2 days, and you get that sharpness back the last couple of days there. And then you get to race day, and you're like, dude, I feel like $1 million. And that's not kind of the difference, like you asked about aging, and the difference, even though 40s and 43 aren't that old, they are in respect to like how much physical fitness, you know, when you're training at a high level. And I would say that that's a big thing I noticed, that when I get to the higher volumes of training at this age, it's harder because you're more sore, you're a little bit more beaten up. But then when you recover and you really come around, you do feel very similar and the same. And you can time it right. You know, you can time it so that you get a lot out of your body still, but you just got to be a little bit more careful.
Well, you've inspired us so much. Where can people come or go to get up with you, to have you be their coach?
Yeah, man. IamWithoutLimits.com. So www.IamWithoutLimits.com.
And you don't have to be locally here to Wilmington.
No,
you can
no.
do anybody.
We coach people from all over the place.
Beautiful.
Anywhere you want. So in this day and age, it's pretty easy to do that.
That's epic. Now, final question. What's the meaning of life?
To love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. The good commandment that God gave us, you know? So I think that doing that makes life a lot, you know, a lot more meaningful, and, you know, love your family, but love your neighbor.
Beautiful. That's episode 49, Speaking from Water, with the legendary Tom Clifford. Tom, thank you so much for joining us and spending this morning. Let's do a check.
We've gone 4.68 miles.
That's it?
Yeah.
Dang. Yeah. Oh, enable battery saver. See? My watch is telling me.
Yeah. And that was a great time.
Yeah, man. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Hope you all listened this far.
Yeah. And thank you all for listening. And we'll see you next time. Peace.